Thank you, everyone. It's really wonderful to be here this morning. This used to be my old stomping grounds down here in Florida. I'm from Birmingham, and I used to come down here in my young years and really have some good times. And those were the days when my drinking was just beginning, though. But first of all, I would like very much to thank those responsible for allowing me to be here this morning. The committee that called me, Ann, and the people that have greeted me. I want to thank you very much for the beautiful fruit that was in my room. I've enjoyed that. And it's just been wonderful. Your friendship is just overwhelming. And it's always this way in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I thank you very much. I want to congratulate you on your 25th anniversary of this Gulf Coast Roundup. I know that's a real milestone, and I hope, like it's been said before, that you have 25 more and 25 more. And I hope I'm around to be there. But anyway, my name is Olga Morris, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. It's through God's grace and with your help that I'm sober this morning. And by trying to practice the principles of this program in my daily life, I've been able to stay sober since September 30, 1966. And for my time with you, I'm so very, very grateful. And I am I'm a person that just absolutely loves Alcoholics Anonymous. I can assure you that I would not be here or anywhere this morning if it was not for this program of Alcoholics Anonymous and for the people that are here and that have been here for me all these years. I still practice this program the same way I did the first day I came in. I was told at the very beginning if I did those simple things that we've just heard talked about, you know, if I just didn't drink and if I came to meetings and if I read the big book, that I could stay sober and I could find that peace and happiness that I'd been searching for all my life. And that's what I found. And I found the promises in this program. They've all come true for me. You know, sometimes I let some of this stuff slip away a little bit, but the difference between then and now is that I know what to do about it. I know when I'm off base, when things aren't going right, that there's some way along the line I've missed it. I just haven't gotten the program that day. And I know real quick that all I've got to do is get down on my knees and turn my will and my life over to my higher power. And that's what I do on a daily basis. I still get down on my knees every morning, and I would not walk out my door without asking my higher power to take charge of my life. Because when I was in charge, I can tell you it was pretty miserable. I mean, it was real miserable. And I know today that if things are going wrong, I'm not doing something that I should be doing. I've missed one of these steps somewhere along the way, and it doesn't take me very long to go back to step one and know that I'm powerless over a disease that will kill me, that will absolutely destroy me and take everything away from me that's near and dear, as it did. And so today I try to keep on base by just following those simple little things that were told me in the beginning. And if I do that, then I don't get into trouble in my life. But anyway, I'm here to tell you what it used to be like and what happened and what it's like today. And all of us know that are alcoholics that it was just pure hell before. It was for me. I can't talk about you, but I can sure share my life with you. And that's what I'd like to do this morning. Now, I'd like to talk to new people, particularly if you old-timers don't mind. I'd like to talk to those that are struggling and trying to find a way to live and not knowing whether or not this is what they want, you know. That just maybe, you know, they're pretty young, you know, and maybe they can just go out and drink a little bit more. Because when we're young, we, you know, that's the things that we think about. No one could have told me when I was 25 years old that I was an alcoholic. No one could have told me that you know, I had to stop drinking because, for me, drinking was my life. It was where everything was, and if you took that away from me, I wouldn't be anything. So I can identify a lot with the young people. And I'm grateful today for the fact that we have the media that has told us all about alcoholism, that we have it in the schools, that every time you pick up a newspaper or a magazine, it's there. We know about the disease of alcoholism, and we know that it will kill, and it does kill. So those are the people I'd kind of like to talk to this morning. And I learned a long time ago that I'm just going to probably reach maybe one person. You know, I'm going to tell my story, and maybe that one person is going to say, if that old gal can do it, maybe I can too. And so that's what I'd like to do this morning. You know, my life was crazy and mixed up. I was a tiny, skinny little old kid, and I was such an introverted little soul, and my life was totally miserable. I came from Birmingham, Alabama. That's my home. I was born and raised there and lived there till I was 30 years old. And I can tell you that I don't think that I would have ever made it without alcohol at the very beginning. I don't believe that I could have gone past the age of 16 without alcohol. And I'll tell you about that in a minute. But this family that I came from was not alcoholic. My mother and father were not alcoholic. I had four brothers, all much older than me, and they weren't alcoholic. And I was the youngest, the only daughter, and the black sheep of the family, and my mother never let me forget it. And I can tell you that I always drank like my Aunt Cora. Now, you got to know that my Aunt Cora was on my daddy's side of the family. It couldn't be on my mother's side of the family. And in latter years, my mother used to say, "You drink just like Aunt Cora," and I did. Now, Aunt Cora was the family drunk. And she was the only person that I ever knew in the family, you know, that had a problem with alcohol. Now, I found out in latter years that my mother had a drunk sister, but we never heard about her. And Aunt Cora used to get in all these ditches and get in jail and wreck cars, you know, and I can remember my mother talking about her quite often. So that was who I became. My mother was a very domineering lady. She ruled everybody, the family, and she just took care of everything that ever happened in our family. My father was a very brilliant man, a research engineer. He worked very hard. He was a hard-working fellow, but his whole life was his work. He was a wonderful father in that he provided well for the family. But the one thing that he never gave to the family was time, and he never gave us what I perceive today as being love. Now, I know he loved me, and don't get me wrong, and I don't blame my mother and father for any of my alcoholism, but I'm just trying to tell you or set up for you the kind of family that I came from. I never can remember any of them telling me that they loved me. I know they did, but I can't ever remember them saying those words. So I grew up so introverted, feeling that I never belonged. I didn't belong to anything in school because nobody ever asked me. I was skinny and tiny and ugly, and the little boys used to call me bird legs, and that sure never helped anything, you know. But I was a grown person all my life, can never remember being a child. I took care of my mother and my father. I would go to town and pay the bills when I was just a little kid, and was always the caretaker, and I'm still a caretaker. I take care of everybody and everything, and I'm not quite as bad as I used to be, but I still do it. Never thought I'd ever be like my mother, you know, this domineering woman that ran the show and ran everything, and I came just exactly like her. And the funny part about it, I like it today. I like me today, and I didn't like it back in those days. I hated school, but I was pretty smart in school. I made good grades. I was real smart in that I thought, you know, if I can study real hard and skip some grades, then I can get out of school real quick. Now, I always wish my daughter could have figured that one out, but she never did figure that one out, you know. But that's what I did. I worked real hard, and I got out of school when I was 16 years old. And I knew exactly what I wanted to do and be when I was 16 years old. First of all, I wanted to get an education, but I wasn't about to let anybody pay for it. I knew I'd go and get a job and work and send myself to school. I also knew that I was going to be the best businesswoman that there was in Birmingham, and that I was going to marry a millionaire. And those were the three things that I knew without a shadow of a doubt that I was going to do in my life, and I set out real early to do that. Now, I became a workaholic long before I became an alcoholic, and I was willing to work and get all these things because I knew that was the only way you was ever going to get this stuff. I also knew that if I worked real hard and got these things, that I was going to find peace and happiness, and that's what I was searching for. These material things were going to allow me to be what I wanted to be in life. And I was willing to work to get those material things. So I got a job when I was 16 working for an insurance company, and I was thrown in with a lot of older women, say probably 20 years old. And I thought they were real old, you know. But anyway, these girls had a little party one day, so they invited me to come to this party. Now, I was absolutely thrilled to death to get to come to this party because I had never been invited to many parties in my life, I can assure you of that. And I wasn't about to say no because I wanted to be sophisticated and I wanted to belong. And so I went to the little party, and they passed these little trays around, you know, with drinks on them, these little tiny drinks. And I took one of them because I didn't want to be different. I always wanted to belong, and I never just could, so I wasn't about to be different, so I took this drink. Now, I've already told you there was no alcohol in our home. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. The only drunk I ever knew about was Aunt Cora. So, you know, drinking, and I just didn't mean anything to me that maybe you're an alcoholic and you take your first drink and there you go. Nothing like that occurred to me. So I took this drink, and when this drink went down, I'm going to tell you, that I don't think that that instant I became an alcoholic. I probably was all along. But what I mean by that is that I did not get drunk with those drinks. But when that drink went down, I can tell you that the whole world changed for me. When it hit bottom, it seemed like the room just smoothed out. You know, everybody was wonderful. And I was no longer unable to talk to people. And I was able to mingle with the crowd. And, oh, I just thought it was wonderful, you know, the feeling that I had. You know, for many, many years in my drinking days, I tried to recapture that feeling of that first drink. And if you don't remember your first drink, maybe you're not an alcoholic, but I remember that first drink. And I knew that I had found the magic elixir that was going to allow me to live in this world and be happy. And I promised myself at that moment that I'm going to have a drink every opportunity I have, and I can assure you that I did. And I did not start drinking alcoholically in the beginning. If there was anything called social drinking, I guess that's what I did for a few years. But, you know, I believe that there are two kinds of alcoholics, and it really doesn't make any difference what kind you are, but for identification purposes, the person that takes the first drink and he becomes an alcoholic instantly, by that I mean his personality changes, he gets in trouble, he gets drunk, and the whole nine yards happens at that particular time. And then there's the kind that drinks of a period of about 10 or 12 years and sort of crosses over into chronic alcoholism, and that was the kind of alcoholic I was. Alcoholic allowed me to live in this world for a few years and be comfortable in my life. As I said, I didn't start drinking and, you know, didn't go out and buy a bottle or anything like that. I just made a promise to myself that if I had an opportunity to have a drink again, I was going to have one. And when I was 21 years old, I got the best job I thought I could ever have. My whole family is inclined to be in engineering type work, and I loved it. I mean, I just knew this was what I wanted to do. And I went to work for an engineering firm in Birmingham. I went to work for a man that was about 20 years my senior. I didn't know at that time he was an alcoholic. How could he be an alcoholic? He drove a Lincoln Continental. He owned a business. You know, why would he be an alcoholic? Couldn't equate that at all. He began to teach me everything I would ever know about the business world, and I was good at it. He also taught me everything I would ever know about drinking. One day, you know, every day he would bring out a fifth of old granddad and sit in the middle of the desk, and he would invite the people that worked around him, the supervision people that worked around him, come by and have a drink before they went home for dinner. And, you know, that was great and fine for people that are not alcoholic, you know. I'm sure there are a lot of people that just go and have a drink and go home and act like normal people. But being a good alcoholic, and he being a good alcoholic, when everybody else would leave, we would finish the fifth, and then we'd go home, you know, only to return back at 8 o'clock that evening and go back to work and work to 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. Did this day in and day out. Hardly ever took a vacation or a day off, and I worked for this man about 9 or 10 years. I became very good in my job. I was a con artist from day one. Most of us are. I would sit in on engineering contracts and engineering talks, and if you didn't know it, you'd think I was an engineer. Could really con my way in. So consequently, I became very good at my job, and I began to make a whole lot of money. And this was really my ideal. Now, I have to go back to 21 when I first got this job and tell you about another important event that happened in my life. I met and married a young man. My youngest brother came home from the Marine Corps, and he was dating my girlfriend, and we were partying a lot. And this young man came into the picture about this same time, and he was very short, and he was blonde. Now, my youngest brother was a tall, good-looking guy, about 6 feet tall. Had black curly hair and was my idol. He was my idol all my life, and I knew that if I ever married anybody, he was going to look just like him, and he was going to dress just like him because he was a swell dresser. He just looked great, you know, and I just thought this is the ideal person. You know, if I ever get married, this guy's going to look just like him. So this young blonde fella came into my life, and he's about 5 feet six, and he wears these god-awful clothes, you know. His suits don't match, his ties don't match, half the time his socks didn't match. And, you know, he just didn't fit into this picture that I had of this guy that I was going to marry, you know. But anyway, I didn't want to be left out because we went out partying a lot and dancing and had real good times, you know, and partying and dancing and then drinking. And I wasn't going to be left out of this picture, so I started dating this young man. And he asked me to marry him the first night that we dated. And he asked me to marry him every night for 6 months. And finally, I said yes. Now, I don't know why I said yes, because I wasn't about to get married unless he was a millionaire and, you know, he met all this criteria. And this young man did not meet all of this criteria. You know, I know today why I married him, because God picked that young man out for me. And I didn't know what love was. You know, if you never felt like you've been loved, how are you going to love somebody else? There's no way that you can give love to another human being when you are self-centered, when you are, you know, you're into self so much that you can't even see anyone else. How are you going to give love to another person? And that's when I know that God came into my life. I know he was there all along. But when I look back in retrospect of my life, I know that God chose this young man for me, because I can tell you one thing. I would not be standing at this podium if it were not for him. But anyway, Jim came into my life, and we got married, and we began a very strange marriage. He worked out of town. He was a workaholic also, but his jobs, you know, never suited me. He would get a job, and I wouldn't think it was good enough, that he was better than that, that he could get another job. And I kept pushing him and moving him up and moving him up and getting him better jobs and making him quit jobs. And I began to buy his clothes, you know. He had to be a dresser, too, you know. So I'd buy his clothes, and I'd buy his ties, and I'd buy his shoes. And I just totally destroyed this man as far as his personality was concerned. I don't guess you can ever take that away. But anyway, I took everything away that I could from this man. But Jim and I, like I said, had a very strange marriage, and it went on like that. And my drinking was getting progressively worse by now. I'm not a drunk, stumbling drunk. The motor section of my brain never ceased to function. I could always work and do my job. I was young, and you can do that when you're young. And I began to get a little bit worse and a little bit worse. By the time I was 30 years old, this man that I worked for had what we might call a wet brain. He just went berserk and crazy and had to give up his job, his work and his business, and I found myself without a job. Now, you would think that a person who had been in this field all these years and was evidently pretty good in it would continue in that field, and I probably could have gotten a job in that field. But instead of that, I got a job with the largest department store of the South. I went to work directly for the president of the company as his right hand. He was in charge of the symphony and fashion show that we put on every year in Birmingham, and we would bring in movie stars from Hollywood and dress designers from Paris and shoe designers from Rome, and my job was to entertain these people. Now, you know why I changed jobs. I mean, I had an expense account. I could wear these $500 designer dresses, and it was an alcoholic paradise. It actually was. So I began to work for this man, and I was still doing a very good job. He thought I was just the greatest. I was getting very sick by this time. By this time, I can't go more than a couple of hours without a drink. It didn't take me very long to discover that if I just took a little drink at home before I went to work in the morning, that my hands would quit shaking, you know, and I could get to work. Now, you got to understand that I knew absolutely nothing about alcoholism. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I really thought I was just crazy. And I thought that till I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I would shake, you know, so bad. And I'd take that little drink before I went to work, and I'd take my bottle with me. And we had a big bar in my boss's office, and I was the only person that had the key to it. And then that bar stretched halfway across the room. And inside that bar was, I guess, every kind of liquor that you could ever imagine from all over the world. And when I left, there wasn't anything left in that bar. I went to the doctor because I thought I was sick. I was sick with alcoholism. And the doctor told me I was diabetic. Well, now, you'd be diabetic, too, if you walked into a doctor's office just having consumed a fifth of a bottle of vodka and had your blood tested. I think you'd be a little diabetic, too, you know. So the doctor told me I was diabetic, and he gave me this beautiful little card to carry that says, "I'm a diabetic. I have not been drinking." Now, I'm going to tell you, if you're going to go back out there and drink, go get you one, because that got me out of more trouble than you can ever imagine. I would flash that card, you know, when I'd get stopped and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, he gave me this card, so I take it, and the sad part about it, I didn't know that I wasn't a diabetic. I took his word for it. So I go back to the store, you know, and I tell all these people I'm diabetic. That's why I'm passing out. You know, diabetics have diabetic comas. I was passing out. Part of my job was sending our buyers to New York twice a week. We didn't have computers in those days, and it was all done by hand. So I could sign these little blue vouchers and take them over to the cashier's cage and pick up $1,000 or $2,000 or whatever it was and bring it back and give it to the buyer, and they'd go. And then when they came back, they would check out with me, you know. Well, I found myself writing these little blue vouchers and going over there and picking up that money, and the money never got to where it belonged, you know. I've laughed about this so many times because one of our speakers from North Carolina used to talk about commingling funds. Well, that's what I was doing, commingling funds. And, you know, the very, very sad part about all of this is I didn't know what I was doing. And I know that might not make sense to some of you, but I would say little things like, you know, they owe me that money. I've worked real hard. Or I'm going to pay that money back payday, and it never got back. How many of you alcoholics had money and you never know where it went or what happened to it? It just goes, you know. And that was the way it was with me. I was living real high, much higher than I should, you know. I was making good money, but I was living far above my means. Money just went, and I never knew where it went to. But anyway, you know, I always thought I was so educated. I had gone to night school for years and years and had what I thought was education. And I thought I was smart. I always thought I was so smart, you know. And I wasn't, but that's what I thought. And it never occurred to this very brilliant person that we had little things called auditors. And if they check up on little things like embezzlement, you know. Anyway, they came around and they did find this money gone. And my boss called me in the office and wanted to know what was going on. And I didn't know. I honestly did not know what was going on. My alcoholism was so bad at this time, half the time I did not know what I was doing. And I'm not making excuses for what I did, but I'm just saying that I didn't know what was going on with my life. He called my husband down, and my husband had to make restitution for this money that I'd taken, and it damn well just wiped us out. It took everything that we had. Now, right then, you might have said, I'm an alcoholic. I better do something about my life and get it straightened out. Instead of that, I went home and I threw my purse on the bed and I turned to my husband and I said, this two-bit town ain't big enough for me. I'm going someplace where they appreciate my talent. And I drove 250 miles to Mobile, Alabama and got myself a job at the largest department store they had down there. They were so grateful to get me. I had told them I worked for this man who was quite well known. They didn't bother to check references and they hired me and they had to fire me within a month's time. Because by now, I'm not only suffering from the disease of alcoholism, I'm suffering from this god-awful guilt. I didn't come from a family of thieves. I know no one in my family that ever took anything that didn't belong to them. And here I was, a thief, and it was just eating me alive. And so the more that it did, the more I drank. And I would have to take my bottle to work, and they found it. And they warned me a couple of times, and then they just fired me. And I went across the street and got a job with their competitor, and I think that lasted about a week. And by now, I'm becoming unemployable. Jim has come down to be with me in my misery. Now, I've got to tell you that Jim was not an alcoholic, but he was becoming as sick as I was. And for you Al-Anons that are in here, you know what I'm talking about. If you live with a practicing alcoholic, you become as sick as they are. And sometimes, I think, sicker. And if he were here today, he would tell you he was sicker than I was, and I believe it. But Jim came down to be with me. You know, he didn't like my drinking. He didn't like the way I was living. And he would often, you know, fuss at me about it and say things to me about it. And I'd tell him, if you don't like the way I live, there's the door. I've supported myself all my life. I've made more money than you've ever made. And if you don't like it, you can leave. It's just that simple. And he wouldn't leave. He wouldn't leave. Thank God he wouldn't leave. Many times, you know, I would drive into a service station and get $5 worth of gas and cash a $10 check. And I began to write these hot checks. And this is part of my story. I'm not proud of any of this stuff, but these are the things that brought me to you. And if they hadn't happened to me, I wouldn't be here. And I began to write hot checks, and I was real good at it. Who wouldn't cash a check for a little old white-headed lady? And I've been white-headed all my life. At least it seems like I have. And I had white hair then. And Jim used to say, I don't know why they'll cash a check to you. I can't even get a check cash when I've got money in the bank. But they did. I had to have money in order to buy booze. And I had to have booze in order to live. And that's the way it was. And I only way I knew to get money was to work for it, and I couldn't work anymore. I was beginning to be unemployable. I could get a job, the most I could ever hold a job would be a week, because I couldn't go without getting drunk. You know, when I sobered up, I got a job out at NASA, and I live out near NASA now, and my husband worked out there. But anyway, I got a job with NASA, and I was the first alcoholic that got a secret clearance at NASA. Used to, you had to have a secret clearance to work there. And they were so enthralled by me that they invited the Naval Intelligence to come down and interview me because they had never known anybody that had 19 jobs in one year. I said, hell, those are the only ones I can remember, you know. But anyway, things were very bad for me in Mobile. The degradation of the alcoholic woman is beyond, you know, just beyond imagination. I know that the men have a real hard time, but drunk women really have a hard time. And so it was with me, because I needed money, and I'd get it any way I could get it, because I had to have it to live. It wasn't a matter of drinking to have fun, drinking to feel better. It was to drink to live. Jim would come. He would get a little job here and there, and like I said, he's as sick as I am, and he can't work either. He can't hold a job more than about a week either. We lived in this little old beat-up house out in Spring Hill, out in the country, and we were repossessed from that house, and one time I set it on fire, and Jim dragged me out. We would steal the water from the next-door neighbor because we had no money, to live, no money to eat, and it was just a terrible, terrible way to live. One day I was walking to the bus station, and I used to throw my empty bottles under a hedge that was there, and this lady came out, and she said, I wish you wouldn't throw those bottles under there. My children are finding them. And you talk about wanting just to die, just want to die for the degradation. Many times I had just enough money to buy a bottle, and I would take the bus down to the liquor stores that opened at 9 o'clock in the morning and be standing in line with the other alcoholics and clutch that money so tightly in my fist, you know, waiting and waiting and waiting for that 9 o'clock to come and running in there and throwing the money on the counter and asking for a bottle of vodka. You know, you can't smell vodka. Throwing the money on the counter and grabbing hold of that sack, you know, and running across the street, and there was a big billboard there on the other side. And I'd get behind that billboard, and I'd tear the top of that bottle off just as fast as I could, and I'd get a big slug, and it would hit bottom, and I knew everything was going to be all right again. And I could start my wheeling and dealing again, and I'd head out in another direction. The police called me in many times and told me they were going to send me to prison if I didn't pick up these hot checks, and I told them with all the earnestness that I had in me that I would get a job and I'd pick up these checks. And we mean it, don't we? We really mean it when we say it, but there ain't no way we can do it. How many times have we told our spouse, I'm going to quit drinking. I'm not going to take another drink. And we mean it. They don't believe us, but we mean it. But we can't do it. There just isn't any way we can do it. And I would walk out of that police station and walk across the street and cash another hot check and get another bottle because I had to live. I always had a car. I am a car person. I love cars. I love fast cars, and I love to drive. And I know I should have been a race car driver in my other life, but I love cars. And I had a car then. I even had a car when I was on Skid Row, and I may have stolen it, but I had one, I can assure you. But I had a car, and it was a 46 DeSoto. Now, you got to believe that this car was unbelievable. It had no floorboard in it, and if I had been a normal person driving that car, I would be dead today. The fumes just came up from that car and would just consume you, you know, when you drove it. And I would get in that car, and I would put an old U-Haul behind it, and I'd head up the highway to Birmingham to my poor old mother's home for her to give me something that I could take back and pawn. I was a great pawner. I pawned my diamond rings. I pawned my fur coat. I pawned the typewriter my father gave me when I was 12 years old, which I would not have departed with today, you know, for anything in this world. And I pawned everything. I even pawned Jim's shoes one time. But it didn't matter. Whatever I pawned, you know, was to get money to buy booze. I mean, that was it to live. And I would put that old U-Haul it back behind that old 46 DeSoto, and I'd head up that freeway, you know, and I'd get conned my poor mother out of something, you know. And we'd be headed back down the freeway, and I'd get in a ditch. I got in every ditch you can imagine up and down that freeway. And one evening, this policeman pulled me over and said, "Lady, you've been in every ditch up and down this freeway, and I'm going to take you to jail." And I said, "Now, wait a minute, officer. You would be drunk, too, if you drove this car. Now, all you got to do is just get in this car and drive it down the road, and I'll follow you with you, but still controlling, see, and directing. And I'll follow, you know, we'll follow you, me and your buddy here, we'll follow you, and you tell me if you wouldn't be drunk if you drove that car." So he gets in the car, and he drives it on down the road. He gets out, and he tells his buddy, he said, "This lady is telling the truth. Anybody would be drunk that drove this car, you know." And I'd get out of it. I always got out of it. And if I didn't, I'd just give them a hot check and poot on down the road. But Mobile was a nightmare. The police had invited me to leave town. The car was being repossessed by the finance company, and Jim couldn't find work, and I certainly couldn't find work. And he came home one day, and he had picked up a Houston newspaper. And in the newspaper, it had, if you've ever seen the want ads in the Houston newspaper, it looks like we could employ the world, you know. So he said, "Maybe if I go to Houston, I can get a job." Now, I thought that was wonderful because I'd been trying to get rid of this guy all these years. You know, I never could get rid of him. This was a wonderful opportunity. Now, I don't know what I would have done if I'd gotten rid of him, because many times he pulled me from a burning house. Many times he had spoon-fed me to keep me alive because I wouldn't eat when I was drinking real bad. One time I was in the hospital, and they gave me 13 quarts of glucose, and I walked out of that hospital and bought a bottle on the way home. So I don't know what I would have done without him, you know, and I know that that's why God chose him for me. But anyway, Jim came on out to Houston. He got a job down on the train stops in Houston, used to anyway, down on Congress Street, which is our skid row. Jim got off of that, got a job washing dishes in a spaghetti joint down there and sleeping in the Salvation Army for 50 cents a night. Now, you got to know that I've got the only Al-Anon that made Skid Row before the alcoholic. But Jim sent for me. It wasn't very long after that, and I'm not going to go in the story about my cats, because anybody knows me knows I'm a cat lover. But anyway, I got all my cats and all my dogs shipped out to Houston. Now, you got to know that I didn't have a dime to my name, but somehow I finagled all of this stuff, and I'm sure with a hot check, and got my dogs shipped out to Houston and my cats. And I got on that train and did a lot more conning to get me out here. Landed down on Congress Street, and Jim didn't meet me that night. And I ended up in an old beat-up hotel down there, and I woke up the next morning. Now, if you've ever seen pictures, and I'm sure you have in movies, of what a room in an old beat-up hotel looks like, that's what it looked like. The old iron bed, and across the room was a dresser, and on that dresser was a bottle of vodka with just a little bit left in the bottom of it. And I said to myself, as sick as I was that morning, if I can just get out of this bed and I can crawl over there and get that drink and get it to stay down, everything's going to be all right again, and I can start my wheeling and dealing again. And that's exactly what I did. Once again, you would think, Skid Row, we talk about Skid Row in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're talking about Skid Row in your heart. We're not talking about the place, Skid Row. So I wasn't about to find sobriety or a new life down there. And I started my wheeling and my dealing. And I conned this lady in renting us an old house, and it certainly wasn't in the best part of town, but it was an old house. I have to know then that once more God stepped into my life that I can see in retrospect, because why would this lady rent us that house? We had no furniture, we had no deposit, we had no job, and all we had was a beat-up suitcase that came with me from Houston. And this lady rented us this old beat-up house. And we slept on the floor at night and covered with the newspapers. And we ate the food that the lady next door who worked at the farmer's market used to bring us, the old dented cans and the vegetables that nobody else wanted. And that was the way we were living. You know, I still have an old can of onion soup left over from that day. And many years ago, it almost exploded, and Jim cleaned it out real good, and he put shellac on it, and we set it back, because I don't ever want to open my cabinet and know that one day I had nothing to eat, no place to go, and I was so very sick. I don't ever want to forget where I came from. because God has been so good to me to give me a new life. And I never want to forget the degradation, the loneliness of the alcoholic woman when I was down on Congress Street. Jim came home one day and he had seen a sign down on Congress that said, "Do you have a problem with alcohol in your life?" And you know what he did, don't you? He called that number, and it was Intergroup in Houston, and they sent a man out to talk to me about my drinking. Now, that was wonderful, wasn't it? No one could ever talk to me about my drinking except my mother. And, that, you know, all she ever said was, "I drank like Aunt Cora." But I agreed to talk to this man because things were not going well with us. And so the man came out, and he told me his story, like we do, you know, when we make a 12-step call. Not too many of those done today, but back in our day, we did that. And he told me his story, and when he left, I told Jim, "That guy has really got a problem, but I don't." You know, we were talking about a few minutes ago, if you ain't got it, you can't give it away. Well, a couple years after I sobered up, I was speaking in Houston. This man came up to me and said, "Olga, I'm the guy that made the 12-step call on you. No wonder you didn't get it. I was drunk when I was talking to you." "Hey, guys, you can't give away, right?" Jim came in, and he had found a little job out at NASA doing some welding. And he said, "Let's move out to NASA, League City, which is about 3 miles from NASA, and let's quit drinking and start over again." And I thought that was the most beautiful thing he had ever said. And I really meant it, you know, that I was willing to do that. So we went to League City. And for some reason, once again, God stepped into my life again, and I was able to stay sober for 3 months. How, I do not know. This is a person that has to go, can't go more than 2 hours without a drink, and I'm talking about around the clock. I'm not talking about during daylight hours. I'm talking about I got to have alcohol in me all the time. Doesn't mean I was drunk all the time. Just mean I got a level of alcohol in me. And for some reason, I stayed sober for 3 months. Now, I don't know why. Maybe a doctor told me I was going to die. That never fazed any of us, did it? And or something. But anyway, I stayed sober for 3 months, and I got a real good job as a secretary for General Electric at NASA. I was making good money. Even got a little commendation from the work, you know, because I was such a good worker. And we rented this little old house, and we began to pay the bills and eat, you know, things like that that are normal to most people. And things were better. And, you know, if you just simply put the cork in the jug, things get better, right? I mean, we all know that you've got to have the 12 steps to live. But I'm talking about just basic things like quit drinking. Things get better. And they did for us. And on December the 15th of 1965, I walked into the house and I told Jim, I says, "They put me in charge of the Christmas party." "You're way ahead of me." We went and I said, "We're going to the Christmas party and I'm going to have one drink and I'm going to drink like a lady." Now, I don't know how ladies drink. You know, I never was one, so I don't know how they drink. But I was going to drink like a lady. No one had ever told me it's the first drink that gets you drunk. And because I always had my way, Jim begged me not to go, but he said, "Let's don't go. You know, things are going good for us." And I said, "Anybody can have one drink and drink like a lady." And I went to the party, and of course I had one drink and many more. And I got very drunk. And being a good workaholic, the next morning, I got up to go to work, and I drove my car and got in a ditch on the way to work. My boss was behind me. He pulled me out of the ditch and took me home and fired me, and that was the end of my job. And I was very, very drunk for the next 6 months, almost, I suppose, in a total blackout. I don't remember anything about it. I just remember going through Christmas with a very tiny little tree that we had, and I still have a little Christmas light that Jim bought me for that little tiny Christmas tree that I put on my Christmas tree every year. Went through that, and on May 30th of 1966, I called Alcoholics Anonymous in a blackout. Don't remember calling them, but they sent their ladies to visit me, and I peeped around the curtains, and I wouldn't let them in. Now, AA women are very persistent ladies. They got me. And they took me to this little group in Dickinson, which is not very far from League City. And I call this my little sick group because I'm the only person that stayed sober from that group. And I went down to that little group, and I would go to every meeting, but I would go drunk. I would have a drink before I went. I'd take my bottle, and I'd have intermission, you know. And I'd go out and have a little drink, and I'd come back. And if the speaker was a loudmouth old broad like me, I'd say, "Why don't you shut up and sit down? I'm tired of listening to you." And I'd kick my shoes off, and it'd go up to the ceiling. Now, you know, if this was your group, you wouldn't tolerate that kind of behavior. We'd own in hours. I mean, we'd either tell them to leave, or we'd take them out and talk to them one-to-one. We'd do something, but we wouldn't let them interrupt meetings like this. And I did this for 3 months, and nobody ever asked me to leave. Now, that had to be a miracle in itself. On September 30th of 1966, I drove my little drunk car home. Now, you know, the little drunk car is the one with all the fenders dented. I bought 2/5 of vodka, drank one, put the other one on the seat of the car, so I had to be pretty drunk because that would be the first place Jim would look for the bottle. And I drove the car home and parked it on the front porch. Jim came out and he said, "You're drunk," and nobody ever called me a drunk but my mother. Okay. My husband was a perfect gentleman. He never in his life ever hit me. Never. He should have. Lord knows he should have, but he never hit me. But he must have really connected, because I went down. And when I went down, I came back up, and you know I did. I broke my leg on the rail of the bed. I ran to the end of the house to call the police to come and get him for striking me. I broke my leg in 2 other places, and I can tell you, I went down. You know, I was, all my life, I was like that little toy doll that some of you old-timers may remember, made out of celluloid, and in the back of it, it had a little spring, and you wind it up real tight, and its little legs are going 90 miles an hour, and you come up against the wall, and it stops, but its little legs are still going 90 miles an hour. It's a perfect description of my life. I was always running and searching and looking for something, and when I got it, it wasn't good enough, and I'd head out in another direction. And when I got that, that wasn't good enough. And I was always looking for something, and I know today that I found it when I found you. I found what I was looking for, my higher power and a way to live and find peace and happiness in my life. And I was laying down on the floor, and Jim came to me, and for the first time, he offered me a drink. And I said, "Jim, you've seen me take the last drink you'll ever see me take." They took me to the hospital, and I was laying in the anteroom, and they had the curtains pulled here and had a great big light shining down on me, and I heard my husband and the doctor talking outside, and the doctor said, "Mr. Morris, we can't operate on your wife. She's too drunk. We sent for a specialist from Houston, but I don't know whether what they're going to be able to do, if we're going to be able to save her leg, or if we are going, or if we do, she'll probably never walk again." And I heard these words. And I can tell you, as drunk as I was as sober as I am right now. And I said for the first time a prayer to my higher power from a God that I had not even acknowledged since I was a little girl. And I said, "God, if you'll give me back my legs and let me walk again, I'll walk the rest of my life the way you'd have me go." And God gave me back my leg. I stand here today with the metal plate from my knee to my ankle, and I don't even limp. Another miracle in my life. I lay in that hospital for 2 months. I was recovering not only from the drug alcohol, but from other drugs that they gave me. They knew absolutely nothing about alcoholism. They gave me Librium. They gave me everything they shouldn't have given me. And I was a very sick person. And one night I was laying in the bed, and they had me in my legs all stretched up. They had me tied down practically, had the sides of my beds up. There was no humanly way that I could get out of that bed, and yet they came in the room and they found me in the middle of the floor. Because you see, in the back of the room, I saw a bar, and on that bar was 6 bottles of booze. And on the other side of the room, there was a door, and a man was standing in that door. Now, I don't know what any of this represented. I don't know if I was hallucinating from all of the drugs they were giving me, or if I had a very, very great spiritual experience. But I do know from this day, from that day to this day, I've not wanted nor desired a drink of alcohol. And that is indeed a great miracle. I knew one thing, you know, the loneliness of the alcoholic. I lay in that hospital room and not a soul came to visit me. My family in Birmingham probably wished to heck I died. My husband wouldn't come and see me. He was ready to just end it all. The AA people didn't come to see me. And I knew the loneliness. I knew that God-awful fear that only the alcoholic who's just sobered up knows
that we don't know what we're going to do. I knew one thing. I was going to stay sober, but I didn't know how I was going to do it. And I started going back to Alcoholics Anonymous when I got out of that hospital. I was in a wheelchair. I was in a cast from my waist to my toe. And these people came and picked me up and took me to that little group. And I sat in my wheelchair in the back of the room, and I wasn't that arrogant, self-centered character that was there before. I would hold my head with my hands, and I would listen to you people, and you were my big book because I couldn't read. Couldn't comprehend, didn't know who I was, didn't know where I was, didn't know what I was doing, but I was there. And I kept going back. And one day I met my sponsor, and she began to take me to other meetings, and I began to see that Alcoholics Anonymous was not just my little group, but was everywhere. And I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous without even knowing it. One night I was going to get drunk at my husband. You know, I don't understand when we sober up why we think our mates all of a sudden should be Mr. or Mrs. Wonderful. But we do. You know, here we've run over these people probably for 20 years of their lives. And all of a sudden, you know, they're supposed to be wonderful too. And it just doesn't happen that way. Now, Jim was going to Al-Anon, but we both had not been sober very, long. And here I was going to get drunk at him because he wasn't paying attention to me and he wasn't working this program, and I had 100 reasons. Now, I'd kept a six-pack in my house to prove to myself I didn't have to drink it. Now, I don't recommend that to anybody, but I did. And I was in this wheelchair, and it was raining that night, and I was into self so much. When he hit the front door, I said, "I'm going to get drunk." And he said, "I don't give a damn if you do." Now, he had heard that from Al-Anon. He had never told me that before, and it made me mad. And all of a sudden, you know, all the anger that I have just mustered right in me. And I was so angry and so mad, and I reached over from my wheelchair and almost pulled the whole closet door down trying to get that six-pack. Picked up that six-pack and threw it back here on the table, and just a second sanity returning, I said, "Ain't no son of a bitch in this world worth getting drunk over." Now, I don't talk like that today. My sponsor told me to clean up my life and my mouth, and I have. But that's part of my story. But anyway, I knew right then that I was going back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going back for me. You know, I was going back for me, not for Jim, not for anybody else, and I did. My sponsor told me, she said, "Olga, that there are some things that you've got to do about straightening out your life." She said, "You've got to take an inventory." And I said, "Well, there ain't nothing good about me, you know, all these things I've done and all this, you know." She said, "You're sober, aren't you?" I said, "Yeah." "Put that on the asset side." And I can assure you that's all I had going for me was a simple fact that I was sober. And I could think of a jillion things over here on the debit side, you know. One of the things that I had to do is that I had to make amends to a lot of people that I'd hurt. There was no way in this world that I could make amends to this man that I had totally destroyed. Absolutely no way. He had heard "I'm sorry" so many times that it was just nothing, you know. I knew the only way in the world I could make amends to him was to straighten up my life and stay sober and be the girl that he had married. And that's what I tried to do. My mother died 2 years before I sobered up, and I wasn't able to make amends to her. And I think that was the thing that hit me the hardest, was not being able to make amends to her. And thank God I had a sponsor that told me, "Olga, if God can forgive you, surely you can forgive yourself." And I'm going to tell you, if I ever bought anything that you had to offer me, I bought that one. I know today that my mother knows exactly where I am this morning. I know when I pass her picture that sits on my dresser and that white curly hair is there, that she knows that my life is okay today, that I'm doing the things that my God wants me to do, and that I'm traveling the path that he wants me to travel. And so I'm at peace with that. But you see, my youngest brother sent me money to come to the funeral, and they poured me on the plane in Houston, and they poured me off in Birmingham, and I was drunk at the funeral home and embarrassed this fine family of mine. And it took me a long time to forgive myself for that. I was drunk at the funeral the next day and embarrassed the family once more. I wouldn't allow my oldest brother to come to the funeral. He hadn't spoken to my mother in quite a few years and had broken her heart. And, you know, it never occurred to me how I had broken my mother's heart. But I wasn't going to let him come and be a big shot, you know, and show up at the funeral. And I called him and I told him, "If you show up at the funeral, I'll blow your brains out." And he knew I was capable of doing it. And he didn't come to the funeral. I knew I had to go back and make amends to this guy, and I was scared. And I wanted to do it by letter, and my sponsor wouldn't let me. She said, no, you got to do this in person. And I drove 670 miles, I think it is, from Houston to Birmingham by myself, went out to the plant where he worked, and I told the guard to call my brother up that his sister's here, but please don't tell him she's here because he probably won't come if he knows it. And I was shaking more than I have ever shook in my life. Now, I've stood at this podium, and I've talked to thousands of people at one time and been scared half to death, but I guarantee you I was scared because I thought he would kill me when he saw me, and he should have. But when he came up from the plant and came up those steps and I was standing across the hall, a great big smile came on his face, and I ran across the room, and I threw my arms around him, and I said, Ed, will you forgive me for the things I've done that have hurt you? And he said, oh, but I've hurt you too. And in just a moment, all the hate in the world drained out of me. I'm going to tell you, I hated that guy. I drank over him more times than you can ever imagine. I just hated him. And all the hate in the world went out of me. Now, my oldest brother is 19 years older than I am. And I never had anything really in common with him. But I can go back home today and spend an hour or two with him and take him out to lunch or dinner or something. And we're friends today. In fact, I just visited him. I spoke in Atlanta last weekend, and I went over to Birmingham because he's been very sick. He's way up in years now, and I was able to spend a couple hours with him. Isn't it a wonderful thing that Alcoholics Anonymous allows us full circle to get back into our family and our lives and get our lives straightened out? I had a lot of amends to make to a lot of people, but those were the most important ones at that time. A lot of people didn't know about my alcoholism or about it being as bad as it was, but those were the main ones that I needed to do. I've been sober about 2 years, and Jim and I decided that we wanted to adopt a child. We didn't have any children. God blessed me with not, excuse me, not having any children because he knew I couldn't take care of him, and thank God I never had any to drag through what I went through. But we decided we wanted to adopt an older child and bring someone into our lives and give them the kind of love that both of us felt like we had missed all of our lives. So we put our application into the state of Texas, and we hadn't heard anything from him. It had been about 18 months, and we hadn't heard a word from him. And so I told Jim one evening, and I says, well, I guess God has said no. You know, no used to never be in my vocabulary. If I wanted something, I got it. I didn't care who I ran over to get it. I can assure you, if I wanted it, I got it one way or the other. But I learned in this program that God says no many times. Wait, there's something better on down the road. And so I told Jim, I said, I guess God has said no. And we both accepted that and went on about our way. And it wasn't too many days after that that the phone rang. And this lady said, Ms. Morris, we've got a little girl for you. She's 4 years old and her name is Becky. And Becky was born May 30, 1966, the first day that I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're both 27 years old today. And we both act like it, too. And this precious little girl came into our lives, and no one in this world could love a child any more than we love that little girl. We hadn't expected one so young, but we certainly weren't going to say no. And Jim used to put her on his knees at night, you know, and cuddle her up real close and put his arms around her and tell her that he loved her every single night. And there wasn't a night that she and I didn't get out on our knees and say the Lord's Prayer together. And all the time in the morning when she'd go out to go to school to catch the bus, and she'd be halfway down the road, and I'd put my head out the door and say, Becky, I love you. Embarrass her to death, you know. But I never wanted this little girl to say, my mother never told me that she loved me. My God, if you've got children, go home tonight and snuggle them up close and put your arms around them and tell them that you love them. You may have said it 1,000 times and they may never have hurt you. When Becky was 18, she walked in the house one day and told us that she didn't love us anymore, that we had never done anything for us, and she was going to leave. And she walked out of my life and Jim's life. And Jim, being the good Al-Anon that he was, he could take this and he could handle it, but I couldn't. This old gal that had spouted her mouth all over this country to the girls that she sponsors, you know, always telling them how they could do things, couldn't handle her own life. And I had been invited to speak in New York, and I told Jim, I'm not going to go. I can't go because I don't believe that if you can't work this program and you're not working this program, you ain't got no business talking at this podium. And I'm not going. And he said, Olga, I've never known you to renege on a commitment in my life, and I'll go with you. And so we went. And it was in the beautiful Catskill Mountains in New York, in the most beautiful place I'd ever seen. It was in November, and the leaves were changed, and it was absolutely beautiful. And I stay in my hotel room out looking these mountains, and I pray to this God of my choice to help me to get back on track and to accept things that I cannot change and to get my life in order again. And I was a Sunday morning speaker, and I spoke that Sunday morning. I have no idea how I got through it or what I said. And I was walking back down the hallway, and this young man yelled out, said, Olga, can I talk with you? And I said, sure. And I stopped, and he said, I'm so glad you came. He said, I had a magnum pistol in my mouth, and I was going to blow my head off. I had 5 years sobriety. I got on Valium, and I lost my sobriety, and I couldn't handle it. And I was going to kill myself, and my wife stopped me. And I was on my way to a treatment center, and I asked him if I could come up here this morning to hear you talk. And you have told me what I need to hear to stay sober. And I knew then why God had picked a little old gal from Friendswood, Texas, to go all the way up to New York to talk to a bunch of people, because there was one person out there that needed to hear the message that I had to take to them that morning. And that's what this is all about. It's about our sharing on one-to-one with another alcoholic. It's not about standing up here at this podium and being a big shot. It's about carrying the message, and that's where the importance of all of this program is in my book. I went back home, and of course Becky came home and brought this young man, and we gave her a big wedding, and she stayed married to him about 5 years and three little children later. And he walked out and left her. And he's a drug addict, and whether or not he ever finds this program, I don't know. He certainly had an opportunity to. But he walked her out, and she's raising these three little precious boys by herself. And they're 7, 6, and 5 years old, and they're the love of my life. You know, God has allowed me to do everything that I'm capable of doing in this program. I've always been a real greedy person. I never just wanted the little part of the pie, you know. I wanted the whole thing. And so, being a good workaholic, I was willing to work for it. And I got real involved in this program. I was 6 months sober when I started going up to the women's prison because, but for the grace of God, I should have been there. And prison work has been a part of my life ever since. I've been a delegate from our Southeast Texas area back in about 1975. I've just rotated off of the board of directors of Alcoholics Anonymous as a committee person on the correctional committee. I served 4 years in New York for that, and that was the greatest experience, one of the greatest experiences of my life. And I've worked with many, many alcoholics. I was allowed to do everything in my personal life that I wanted to do. I started a business when I was 53 years old. I walked into the bank and I asked this banker there in our little town of Friendswood to lend me $4,000 to start this office supply business, and he looked at me like he thought I was crazy. And he said, there's no way that you can start an office supply business with $4,000 worth of borrowed money. I said, you don't know me. And he refused to give me the loan, and I went to another banker that I heard about, and he loaned me the $4,000, and I started this business with $4,000 of borrowed money. And I sold it in 1985, and it was very thriving, and in fact, the business is still going on today. You know, I believe that God allows us to do whatever we are capable of doing in this program. I've owned two businesses. I've done everything I've wanted to do. January of 1991, be 3 years this January the 18th, this precious man that I loved and adored had a massive heart attack and died. I didn't know what love was till I found you. Jim and I had the most beautiful marriage of anybody that I know, and I've known a lot of people. We allowed each other to be ourselves. He allowed me to be me, and I allowed him to be him. I didn't tell him how to dress anymore. I didn't tell him what kind of job he should get, and you know he ended up with the best job he ever had, and I didn't have a thing to do with him getting it. He had just retired from NASA as project manager for construction, making more money than he ever dreamed he'd ever make. And he did it all by himself. So being an alcoholic doesn't just give you the privilege of doing something with your life. If you're Al-Anon, you can do it too. This program works for everybody. So we were able to get our lives back together again, and we had a wonderful marriage. I said for me, life began at 40, because that's how old I was when I sobered up. And my marriage began at 40. But on January the 18th, our 44th wedding anniversary, this very precious person left me. I was in Dallas, Texas at the time at a delegates conference. I didn't want to go, but Jim always wanted me to do the things in Alcoholics Anonymous that he knew were so important to me. And it took me a long time to get over the fact that I wasn't there when this happened. He just went out to eat and just fell over. I thank God today that he was never sick. And I thank God that he's up there with a lot of our friends. And he's in the big meeting today. And he knows where I am today. But after he died, I couldn't get a hold of myself. It took me about 6 months. I was in a terrible depression. And I've never been depressed in my life that I can remember. And I wondered if God was through with me, if this was the end, and I should just, you know, forget about everything and, you know, just hang around. And I knew that's not the way that Jim would want me to go. And I went back to college, and I got my state license to be a counselor, substance abuse counselor. Something I said I would never, ever do. Never say never. But I said I'd take one course to see if I could pass it. It had been 100 years since I had been to school, you know, and I made an A on my first course, so I guess I said, well, I guess God wants me to go on, and I took the second one and ended up taking all of it, and I got my state license. I was hired by the prison system in Texas, the love of my life. The boys and gals in white. And I became a counselor for the substance abuse facility in Ramsey 2 in Texas. I guess most of you know that our governor is a recovering alcoholic, and she self-proclaims that, so I guess it's okay to say it. And she has established these private prisons, substance abuse prisons in Texas, and I have 200 guys that have an alcohol and drug problem. And I'm doing the thing that I love to do the most, carrying the message to these guys. I've learned to separate my job from my Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and life, and that's the way it has to be. And about 3 weeks ago, I was made clinical supervisor, this old broad, and I got this job over a very young girl, and I absolutely couldn't believe it. But God is still looking after me after all these years. I'm going and doing the things that I love to do most, carrying the message to the alcoholic that's suffering. I'm with my daughter and my three grandchildren that I love so very much. My youngest brother and his wife are here with me this morning, and that's a thrill for me. They are not members of AA or Al-Anon, but they know a little bit about this program, and they certainly support it. And I'm grateful for that. I believe that if you put action into this program, you can do anything you want to do. You know, you can pray all day long for this light to turn on up here. But if you don't flip this switch over here, baby, it ain't going to turn on. You're going to have to get off your duffer and get busy if you want the things that are available to you in life. And I believe truly that anybody can do anything that they want to do, that they're capable of doing in this program. I am so grateful today for the young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wish I could have sobered up when I was 25 years old, but it wasn't meant for me. I couldn't stand up here and tell how this program has worked for me if I had sobered up at 25. But you can, you young people. You can carry the message. And being young, we need you. You're the lifeblood of Alcoholics Anonymous, the young people. I hope and I pray that God will give me an opportunity to be around long enough to continue with my work in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I don't think God's through with me yet. And I don't think He's through with you. And I hope and I pray that we can all be together again, hopefully down here one day, and I can see my new friends that I've met this weekend. May God bless you and keep you, and God bless Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.